This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. From time to time, we receive story ideas from listeners. Here's one that came in recently.
Dear friends at Only a Game, it occurred to me, especially in the midst of the pandemic, that you might enjoy another positive sports story to report on.
That's listener Daniel Baralski reading an email he sent a while back.
I've enjoyed for years a British show called Taskmaster.
Hello, I'm Greg Davis and this is Taskmaster. Thanks for having us in your lives. It's episode 5 of series 5 and there are 5 contestants, each waiting to battle it out for a maximum of 5 points in the 5 tasks we've scheduled for tonight's competition. Coincidence? Yeah, it is coming.
Taskmaster is a huge hit in the UK, recently signing a deal for 6 more seasons that were supposed to begin airing in late 2020. But as Daniel explained, during social distancing, Taskmaster hosts Alex Horn and Greg Davis have been organizing challenges for people stuck at home. They call it home tasking.
Turn your kitchen into a sporting arena and create the most epic moment of sporting glory.
Taskmaster co-host Alex Horn, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Karen. Lovely to meet you. I don't know where you are.
I'm in a closet in Boston.
Boston, yeah. I knew about the closet. I just didn't know where the closet was located.
Well, before we get into those epic moments of sporting glory, I want to try to explain the concept behind the show. It all started with an event you put on for the 2010 Edinburgh Fringe Festival. So what inspired you?
Well, my first son was actually born. I always used to go to the Edinburgh Festival and I missed one because of the birth of the child. And so out of jealousy, I set up my own sort of mini festival, mini awards. I sent an email to 20 of my friends who were comedians saying, would you like to take part in this thing? I'm going to set you a challenge every month. And at the next Edinburgh Fringe, we'll do a show to see who's won. So the very first task was deposit some money in this bank account. Most money wins. And that was it. That funded the whole thing. And I instantly knew that comedians were competitive and they all wanted to win. And then we did it again the next year because it was so much fun. And eventually it sort of drifted onto TV.
Okay, so how does this work as a TV show? Describe how it all happens.
Well, there is a man called Greg Davis, who is the taskmaster. I'm his assistant, and we set tasks to 5 comedians. And the tasks will be something like paint a picture of a horse whilst riding a horse.
I feel more comfortable about painting a horse probably than riding one.
They come and do it individually, so they don't see how each other's done. And then we get to the studio at the end of the series and Greg judges them.
That is one of the worst paintings I've ever seen in my life. In fact, it's genuinely infuriated me.
So it's pointless, ludicrous stuff. Often the most stupid things are the funniest. Often the people who do the worst are the most popular.
So do you have a favourite task maybe among those that are currently available on YouTube?
There was one which it was give Alex a special cuddle. I'm Alex.
Oh, Alex.
My time starts now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, my instinct is to remove all my clothes, but I think that that's just more my general instinct is to do that at any given time.
So one of my favourite comedians is a man called Bob Mortimer, and he wanted to cuddle me in the boot of his car. So we spent half an hour in the dark of the of the back of his car. So it's when you get into situations you would never have dreamt of. You go to work in the morning, and at the end of it, you come home and you've been cuddled in a car.
And this managed to turn into quite a successful TV show, right?
Yeah, it's done all over the world. So we get to see it in Finland and Belgium and Australia. So, it's still going, which is extraordinary considering how stupid it is.
All right. So your show, at least the part where the taskmaster gives his rulings, that part is filmed in front of a live audience. So the obvious thing to do during the pandemic would be to just take a break for a while. How did the idea of home tasking first come up?
Yes. So home tasking, it wasn't my idea. It was some parents got in touch. So here in the UK, when they announced that the schools were shutting, there was a wide-scale panic amongst parents. And lots of kids watched the programme here. So some parents said, would you mind setting some tasks to my kids just to pass some time? So I set a task, which was throw a piece of paper into a bin. Most spectacular throw wins. And that was meant to be it. And so many people did it around the country and then around the world that we've carried on ever since.
So you announced that first task on March 23rd.
OK, good morning. I have the first task.
Were you at all nervous? I mean, what if nobody actually did the task and sent in a video?
Well, I wouldn't really have minded. I don't think I was nervous because it wasn't. It's not really a thing. It's just, it's what the internet is best at, I think, is when it's pointless stuff for no real reason. And since then, because we've carried on and it's built momentum, I now get nervous. I set a task and I worry that no one will do it well. But every time I've been surprised by the breadth of imagination.
So I noticed that between the first and second task, you went from saying, please keep your clips to under 60 seconds to please keep your clips to under 20 seconds. So I'm thinking you were having trouble watching all those videos.
Yeah, things changed pretty quickly after day one. So it was just me. And then we had to rope in a lot of volunteers from the production company who are also at home, you know, at the moment. So there's 10 people now watching all the stuff. Everyone works on a 2-hour shift. Because there's not enough time in the day to watch all the clips, even at 20 seconds. So there's a system where they filter through the ones which they think are best. I watch as many as possible. We think every single entry is watched by one of us. And then I filter the best down to Greg, and he judges the top 10. And eventually we end up with one winner.
The task that got our attention was actually the fifth home task, create the most epic moment of sporting glory in the kitchen. What was the inspiration behind that task?
Well, most of them were inspired by me spending too long in the house, like we all are. So wandering around the house thinking, oh, we've not done anything in the kitchen. I really like it when people completely turn their house upside down, and giving them all of sport to choose from means you're sort of, you're going to get some interesting entries. I think skiing was, I liked it when people turned their kitchen into a ski resort. That shows the length that people went to.
Okay, so the video montage starts with two kids standing on either side of a kitchen island over which a tennis net has been strung. One of the kids is wearing a brown curly wig, the other is wearing a longer blonde wig, and they're using frying pans as tennis rackets.
Out.
You cannot be serious!
And over the next, I don't know, 8 minutes, we see clip after clip after clip of creative, ambitious, and ridiculous attempts at this task. What was it like for you as you watched those come in?
It's so funny, and it's such a privilege, really, because you see the first good one come in, which is normally amongst the first couple. You go, oh, wow, I wasn't expecting that. I thought people would use their kitchen sinks because that involves water. And we often get people using Lego and that sort of thing. But it's when people do things you would never have imagined that you're really surprised. People turned their kitchen into a proper Formula One racetrack, you know, and had actual cars with engines going around it somehow. And the McEnroe thing, a few people came up with that. And that's always a pleasure as well, when you see different people's take on the same idea. And you think, gosh, that person in America came up with the same idea as that person in London. And that's quite unifying. And also you get some really just bad attempts with people falling over laughing at the end of it. And I enjoy them just as much.
How many people do you think have participated in home tasking so far?
It's a very good question. I don't know. We know we have thousands every time. We've got to know a few people. There's a baby in Ireland who's appeared in every single one. She was 11 weeks when she started. She's got her own Twitter account, and she's made a montage of her life in tasks. So, yeah, thousands, I suppose.
And why? Why are so many people tearing apart their kitchens to make videos for you for free?
Well, I don't think they're doing it for me. I'm hoping they're doing it for themselves, because I guess we all need a bit of direction at the moment. But I think they're competing with other people, not against other people, if you see what I mean. So they're doing a thing that other people are doing, and they can then sit down as a family and watch how other people interpreted it. So it's quite a unifying thing, and it's not to win money, and it's not to win fame. So hopefully it's just a positive thing in the week.
What I really love about these videos, and it's really kind of the only thing I love about this particular moment in history, is that we're really seeing families come together. What has it been like for you to be part of that?
It is sort of spine tingling every time. I haven't got bored of it or used to it, really. I really like the ones when the older generations have clearly been cajoled into it by the younger generation. There was reenact a moment from history. One of the top 10 ones was this old guy in Ireland who is trying to rid Ireland of the snakes. And we found out afterwards that his son asked him to do it. His son was in England, and he recorded the snake element with the socks on his hands. And his dad, with his old guy with white hair, dressed up as St. Patrick, was shouting and swearing mildly at the socks.
Oh, you bunch of filthy snakes. Oh, go on, though. Oh, for the love of God.
You know, it brought them together across the Irish Sea and to do a really stupid thing. And then thousands of people get to watch that on YouTube. So that's always joyful.
As you mentioned, your co-host Greg Davis is the taskmaster.
And Nish is in last place. I'm not going to justify it because he's already annoying me.
Usually he's quite a gruff and unbending kind of guy. Do you think people are getting to see a softer side of the taskmaster during these challenges?
Yeah, they definitely are. And there's been some upset about that. Some loyal fans of the show are saying, why is he treating people so nicely?
Incredible work. One of my hardest to judge so far. Here's some honourable mentions. Lily Von Skiing Baby, incredible. Tom Cable, butter skating. I loved it.
But I think he feels a responsibility as well. He started, actually, just occasionally you see the true Greg when he undercuts an attempt. But yeah, he's loving it as well, to be honest. I think just it gives us the feeling of being vaguely useful.
I'm wondering, once people start going back to work and school, will you keep issuing home tasks?
Well, I think I definitely will, yeah. We'll do it this way until the schools reopen. But I think after that, I've really loved doing it and have been so amazed by the results that I think people deserve to keep doing it if they want to. So I'll definitely keep doing it in some form. And also, I think at the moment, we've been limited to the houses. And I think once people can go outside again, they'll get up to all sorts of stuff. I mean, it's going to be awful. So no, it'll definitely carry on in some shape or form.
Alex, thanks so much. This has been fun.
Pleasure, Karen. Very nice to meet you in your cupboard in Boston.
Alex Horn is the co-host and creator of Taskmasters. Episodes are now available on YouTube. You can find the next Home Task Challenge issued on Mondays and Wednesdays on YouTube and Twitter. We'll have links at onlyagame.org. British rugby commentator Nick Heath created a Twitter sensation when he posted play-by-play of mundane scenes in his neighborhood.
The joke is in this guy who's a commentator. He's almost just excited to be out of the house, and his day is happy as a result.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Want to add more positivity to your podcast feed? Check out Kind World, stories of extraordinary kindness and compassion.
That's Kind World. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Karen Given. Joe Buck calls the Super Bowl the U.S. Open Golf Tournament and the World Series. But recently, he was heard calling feeding time at a Twitter follower's chicken coop.
Wow, look at that move by the bigger one up on top of that little seesaw thing. I mean, this puts gerbils and habit trails to shame.
Scroll through Twitter these days and you'll find very serious pro announcers offering play-by-play of incredibly silly things. How did this all get started? Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story.
Nick Heath is a play-by-play announcer, or as the Brits say, a commentator who calls international rugby matches.
Young's to the right-hand side, to Flood. Flood takes a step and thought he saw a gap where Mark Chisholm was lurking. But there wasn't one. Young's.
Or at least that's what he did before the pandemic.
You know, my social following was about 15,000 on something like Twitter. And my content would be interviews with rugby players and rugby news and updates and bits and pieces of promoting where I'm at and what I'm doing.
England's rugby premiership is set to postpone their league season. Plus,
obviously, as we saw the spread of COVID-19 beginning to hit across the world, then the sporting fixtures started disappearing from the calendar, and I was left with my livelihood disappearing in front of me.
For Heath and many professional broadcasters, no games has meant no income. But Heath says he didn't panic.
I ended up getting a little bit inventive. Took myself off for a walk and saw a couple of guys hopelessly kicking a football around a park and just thought, well, maybe while I'm sat here in the sunshine, I can just film a bit of them doing what they're doing and put a silly voice over the top.
And, that was absolutely terrible. That's what we've come to expect, really, from these two.
And, well, that's when the trouble started.
On March 17th, Heath posted the video on Twitter.
And a few hours later, I noticed that it had had 60,000 views, which is more than I would expect. And yeah, so when I saw that was going on, I thought, well, this is obviously tapped into a few other people who are entertained by a slightly inane, silly thing, and didn't think an awful lot more of it than that. but I woke up the next morning and was getting messages from friends who'd heard the clips played out on the BBC Radio 1 Radio Breakfast show, which is a big show, and I thought maybe I should just go out and film a few more of these while people are enjoying them.
Heath has shared nearly 30 of what he calls his life commentary videos, shot in and around Tooting, the neighborhood in London where he lives. They feature real-life scenarios, ranging from the utterly mundane to the slightly more exciting.
I've tried where possible not to kind of film people's faces, that kind of thing, because, you know, the joker's in this guy who's a commentator. He's almost just excited to be out of the house, and his day is happy as a result.
Nowhere is that more evident than in Heath's description of pedestrians navigating a crosswalk outside the Tooting Broadway tube station.
Crossroad dash, light turns to red. We wait for the beeps. There they are now then. JD Sportsman, he's got a decent start. Leggings on the outside. Oh, JD Sportsman's been distracted over the shoulder, and Leggings is going to get there. Oh, she does it again. 3 titles in 3 days. Off past Vegas Gold for the lap of honour. Victorious.
How similar or dissimilar are your approaches to commentary as a sports broadcaster and your approach to commentary during a pandemic?
Hopefully remarkably different, but perhaps my employers can tell you they're closer than I wish they were. Yeah, I mean, when I'm commentating on a rugby match, the important thing for me is to make a key observation, to try and paint a picture if it's on radio that really resonates with somebody and has an authenticity to it. In broadcasting, for me, it's important to be authentic, and the voice of the character I do in all of this is certainly not that.
Heath doesn't know how long it will be before he draws his next commentating paycheck. In the meantime, he's licensed an ever-growing collection of life commentary-inspired merchandise, including Spaniel Speedway t-shirts and coasters, and throw pillows celebrating a snail named Les Cargo's epic 15-millimeter race across a sidewalk.
His trail showing the amazing distance he's covered in the last 7 months. Now, Les is known for his up-and-over technique, and we've not seen...
Just after Heath began posting his videos on Twitter, he was contacted by legendary Scottish sports broadcaster Andrew Cotter.
He said to me, well, it's funny, you put out your live commentary clips at about the same time I just filmed my two dogs having dinner, but I couldn't very well put them out because I would have looked exactly like I was copying you. But knowing Andrew, knowing how much more established he is as a broadcaster over here, I sort of said, look, you've got to put it out.
20 seconds to go now. Olive closing in on victory and that coveted prize of being told she's a very good dog. One paw to control and a switch. Now Mabel sensing this might be a chance, still waiting, still believing.
Cotter's play-by-play of his two dogs, Olive and Mabel, strategizing over a rubber bone, has racked up about 19 million views on Twitter.
That's way more than a big rugby international would get on views here in the UK.
And it's gone, and Mabel takes it. No mercy from the younger dog, who takes this victory just as time runs out. A famous win built on patience and sheer belief. For Olive, only thoughts of what might have been, but only herself to blame. She's given this one away, and that will hurt most of all. Bad dog.
Back on this side of the pond, and a couple thousand miles inland, Connor McGahey is a radio and television play-by-play guy for the Colorado Avalanche. He's also the PA announcer at Denver Broncos home games, when there are games.
Every single thing about calling the games, about doing them, I miss.
When McGahey saw the videos by Heath, Cotter, and Buck, he thought it would be cool to try some of his own.
A family locally here in Denver sent a tweet and they said, hey, we miss hearing the Avalanche on the radio. Would you mind doing play-by-play for this altercation?
But it wasn't between hulking ice warriors.
Right, right. Oh, we got a cat fight. He jumps up onto the couch, completely doing away with the height disadvantage. Winston, now chilling, wagging the tag. Oh, and there goes Felix. Felix,
and that turned into 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 pet videos that people would send in.
And a disclaimer, all the videos are playful, not actual fights. And how have people responded to your work? Have the reviews been positive?
Very positive. People say, you know, I don't really care about the hockey, which we would usually get, you know, on this Twitter feed, but I'll stay for the cats.
They stay for the humans, too. one of McGahee's followers presented him with the opportunity to extend his artistic range.
Her mother had just got out of surgery and needed to keep moving and get back to health. So she said, you know, it would be really nice to have some play-by-play to this to get her motivated to come back.
The woman set up a mini obstacle course in a hallway.
With different, you know, toy cars and stuff in the way down a hallway.
17 days on the IR, and here comes cricket. Don't forget about the carpet. Carpet is the underrated monster of this obstacle course, and she gets past it.
Now, after calling all those cat fights, it must have been a relief to have as your subject at least one human.
Yep. And she did a marvelous job.
Colin Cosell is also taking requests. He's the PA announcer at New York Mets home games. He's also the grandson of Howard Cosell. In the absence of pay he'd be earning for that work, Cosell has been recording walk-ups. That's the quick announcement as a batter approaches home plate, often accompanied by music. Cosell has been doing them for anyone who asks. Many of the requests are the kind you'd expect from heartbroken fans and kids with big league dreams. But his best work stems from the more unusual requests.
Ladies and gentlemen, your attention please. John and Michelle are thrilled to announce the birth of their twins, Malios and Murray!
He got one from a synchronized swimmer.
Are you ready for it?
Now swimming for the New Canaan Aquianas, Sweet 16, Alexandra Matthews!
And he even got one from a radio producer who still can't get over the fact that he never made it to the major leagues.
The third baseman, number 15, Gary Wallach!
Cosell says he prioritizes walk-up requests from medical workers and children. When I talked with him in late April, he said he had produced 600 of them. That's about 100 hours of work. Since then, Cosell has gotten another 200 requests. He expects at least a couple hundred more. Have you been tempted to charge money for these?
You know, no one's working right now, or very few people are. The unemployment rate is through the roof, and the last thing people need to be doing is spending money on someone just saying their name into a microphone. So I decided against it.
Cosell's wife is still working from home, so there is income. And Cosell says he's happy to be doing something, anything, for now. But he really misses his day job.
I miss every aspect of it. I miss the excitement of going to the ballpark to call a game, you know, being in the booth, being at Citi Field, opening my window and high-fiving fans as they're leaving, and just that shared joy. And I miss that escape, you know? Now, what do we have to root for? That the numbers plummet, the deaths plummet, those admitted to hospitals plummet? It's a pretty dark way to go through your day. Not to say that I'm not rooting for those things, but I can't focus on that darkness because it will consume you.
So here we are in week 7, or maybe it's week 8, or week 29 of the almost no sports era. Catfight play-by-play guy Connor McGahee can't wait to get back to calling Colorado Avalanche games.
No matter what we've been dealing with in this country over time, we've really had sports to sort of default to and get us through. And that has not been the case this time. And when we get back to it as broadcasters or fans, I think we'll rejoice and appreciate it even more.
Colin Cosell says he'll be among those rejoicing after all the hardships, the dwindling bank accounts, and the sadness.
We are human beings. We adapt, we move on, and when sports comes back, again, it'll just be that much sweeter.
And you're looking forward to that, I'm sure.
You have no idea.
Actually, I kind of do.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
Sp-
sports might be on hold, but we still have plenty to talk about on Only a Game. Make sure you never miss a second by subscribing to our podcast at Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. For Mother's Day weekend, we're re-airing this 2016 story that's as much about parenting as it is about hockey. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
When Walker Aran's parents first realized there was something different about their son, he was just 3 months old.
He was on the living room floor, and Dad was over him, and I could hear Steve going, "Hi, buddy, hi, hi, buddy." And all of a sudden, I heard this little three-month-old baby, clear as a bell, echo his dad, looking straight at him, and this little baby went, "Hi." And I poked my head out of the room that I was in, and I said to Steve, "I did not just hear that." And Steve said, "You did." I said, "I don't know whether to be happy or go, oh my gosh, who does that?"
I was glad she was there to hear it, so I had someone to back me up on it.
But soon, Anna and Steve Aran noticed other unusual things about Walker. Everyday noises set him off. The sound of the microwave door opening or Velcro ripping caused him to throw a fit. Sometimes he wouldn't go to sleep or eat. Anna got a psychologist to check on Walker. Then came a diagnosis: pervasive development disorder, a form of autism.
The person that primarily told us was very matter-of-fact about it and left us with, you know, there's probably not much you can do about this, and so you're just going to kind of have to live with this. And Steve and I aren't really, well, you're just going to have to live with this kind of people.
They responded by setting Walker up with speech, vision, and occupational therapists. And then they stumbled on something that would become another kind of therapy. They took 2-year-old Walker to the nearby ice hockey rink at Davenport University in Grand Rapids, Michigan. About 2 decades later, Walker Aran remembers that moment.
When I first got on the ice, it started off with my dad and my mom trying to hold my hand. And after about 5 minutes, I turned around and I looked at them and I said, I'm okay, essentially. I was like, I got this from here. So it just took off from there.
It didn't take long for Walker to pick up a hockey stick. He found that when he stepped on the ice, his worries disappeared.
It feels freeing, really. I think hockey is a very freeing game, both freeing of, you know, your body and your mind. You know, when you're on the ice, you almost feel like you can fly.
When he wasn't on the ice, Walker watched videos of NHL players and mimicked their moves in his living room. Steve coached all of his son's hockey teams until Walker reached high school. And as Steve recalls, at first, Walker might have loved hockey a little too much.
He's a very competitive guy, very competitive kid, and we had some issues early on with that. Whenever his team lost, his first year, he would just have a meltdown, and he would yell at me and blame it on me, and he would get so worked up he couldn't go on the ice to finish a game.
There were a couple of games when you carried him off by his jersey, kicking and screaming, arms flailing through the air. No, I wanted to win. No, you can't take me off the ice. Okay, yes, we can, son. Here we go.
But the sport's positives quickly outweighed the negatives. Because after Steve and Anna were told that their son wouldn't get past a fourth grade level in math or reading, hockey became therapy. In fact, it replaced more traditional therapies.
We would tie words with plates onto the net, and he would shoot at the letters, and that's how he learned how to spell words. You might not be able to do that with every child, but for him, it worked, and he was motivated to do it. So there he'd be shooting pucks, you know, C-A-T, cat, P-A-N, pan, and he eventually learned to read through some of that and sound things out. And it became his sensory therapy with the crashing and burning on the ice. So it was kind of a multi-purpose thing. And, you know, the bottom line is he really, really loved it, loved it, loved it.
It must have helped because Walker kept advancing through school. He was never held back a grade. Walker didn't tell any other kids, not at school or on the ice, about his diagnosis. But sometimes he had to leave the regular classroom to meet with specialists. And sometimes other students in school noticed.
You know, when someone would ask me, like when I was in middle school or in elementary school, why it was I took, you know, a test or, you know, went to a different room for a class, I was kind of too embarrassed to really say why it was I left, because I was afraid that I would get made fun of or be judged. So I would just kind of sheepishly look away and not really say anything.
And when Walker moved on to high school, he continued to keep his disorder a secret from other students and his new hockey teammates. Walker's parents worried about how their son would manage in a high school locker room.
He's coming in as a 14, 15-year-old, and there are some of these guys that are 18 years old. They're young men, and they're talking about a whole different set of things.
I was petrified.
They were worried because Walker had trouble registering sarcasm and understanding jokes. But Walker soon had an ally in the locker room, and a plan.
Fortunately, he had his younger brother. You know, his younger brother, Brendan, is kind of a social ace. And so they had this little signal worked out in the locker room. You know, Walker would look at Brendan, and Brendan would send Walker the message, dude, that was humor. Right now, on cue, ha-ha, laugh. That was humor. Yeah. So, yeah, right.
That's amazing.
I think so, too.
Walker did well enough in the classroom to earn honors, and he was good enough at hockey to extend his playing career beyond high school. But before he graduated, there was an important school project.
His English teacher at East Kentwood High School asked them to write a paper in which they had to think about one thing they could offer to the universe, to change the universe. And he said, I think I'm ready. I'm ready to let kids my age know that I have autism, but autism doesn't have me. And I was just stupefied. I mean, that was a really profound thought.
Walker wrote the paper on living with autism, and soon he had an opportunity to share his story with an even larger audience. A family friend and local artist was preparing for an upcoming competition in Grand Rapids called Art Prize. She wanted to paint Walker, and next to the painting, she wanted to include an excerpt from his essay. And this wasn't just any art event. Held in downtown Grand Rapids every year, Art Prize attracts hundreds of thousands of attendees. Walker considered the offer for about a week, and then he agreed to have his story included. And then on the day it opened,
he came home from school and he said, Mom, this freakish thing happened today. He said, I'm sort of freaked out about it. He said, all of these kids saw my painting. And he said, my phone is blowing up. He said, I bet I have 150 texts. Is that you, Walker? Is that you, Walker? He said, Mom, I didn't know I had friends. I said, right. I said, how you feel about all this? He said, I've decided it's okay.
After a year playing junior hockey in Wisconsin, Walker enrolled at Davenport University, the same nearby school where he first learned to skate. Once again, he was meeting a new set of teammates who didn't know about his diagnosis. And now, the age gap between Walker and the oldest players was even larger than it had been when he first entered high school.
I was 19, and I was on a team with guys who were 23 and 24 years old. It was intimidating, and I was definitely kind of nervous about maybe how that dynamic would work.
You probably won't be surprised to learn that his parents were nervous, too. But before Walker's first season began, Anna's fears were eased.
I know this is going to sound silly, but it was when he got his first text from Alex Fonseca, an older guy. And Fonzie, they call him lovingly Fonzie, and Fonzie texted him, and I said, oh, who was that? And he said, Fonzie, and I said, the guy on the team, yeah. And I thought, oh, this is cool. He's made a connection, he gets it. He said, Fonzie wants me to come over, and I just went, yes, yes, he does, yes, you're going, yes, go, go, you're going to Fonzie's house, yes, you are, and I didn't even know who Fonzie was.
Fonzie became one of Walker's closest friends, and in his first season on the ice for Davenport, Walker, a defenseman, played in 34 games and scored 3 goals. Thanks to the benefits of all the childhood therapies, on and off the ice, Walker's college teammates might not have known Walker had autism if he hadn't told them. And as he settled in at Davenport, Walker also wanted to share his story. The same guy who used to hide his diagnosis from other students and teammates published an essay about his experience on a Michigan hockey website. Walker Arand has nothing to hide, and he wants to make a difference.
I hope that if there's someone else out there that's like me, that shows them that, you know, there's hope for everybody. If your gut's telling you to go and achieve something, then go do it. And don't worry about what other people tell you that you can and can't do.
That story came from Only a Game's Martin Kessler. Last spring, Walker Arand graduated from Davenport University with his bachelor's degree in marketing. He's now getting a master's in strategic management. Reporter Judith Kogan is quarantining with her 30-year-old son, Matthew. There's only one problem.
The house I moved to after my son's left home lacks a basketball hoop, and Matthew is in basketball withdrawal.
That's coming up, and remember you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Need to escape the news for a moment?
Check out Endless Thread, a podcast from WBUR and Reddit.
From mysteries to histories to stories that will remind you of our shared humanity.
Subscribe to Endless Thread on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, finding time to date is difficult when you're an NBA writer until the season gets put on pause. But now it's time for Charlie Pearson, the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
Don Shula died this week at the age of 90. He was the NFL's winningest coach. He led the Miami Dolphins to the league's only undefeated season. How will you remember Coach Shula?
Well, I think what people are forgetting is that Don Shula coached for a long, long time. He was the losing coach in the famous Joe Namath Super Bowl. Generally, he's remembered, and rightly so, for the Dolphin teams. But this guy was a football lifer, if anyone was ever a football lifer.
Shula was an NFL head coach for 33 seasons. 26 of those were with Miami, and only two of those Dolphins teams finished below 500. And that's why, I'm told, when I attended an NFL game in London, everyone was wearing Dolphins jerseys.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know he was a marketing whiz as well.
The NFL has announced its 2020 schedule, Charlie, and I personally am far less interested in talking about the actual schedule and far more interested in talking about how it was released in a three-hour TV special on the NFL Network on Thursday night. I know we're all really sports-starved, but 3 hours? Are we really this desperate?
That was kind of epic, wasn't it? First of all, who cares, basically? I mean, you're there to cheer for your team.
Yeah.
The New England Patriots have the toughest schedule in the league, with no quarterback, by the way.
Charlie, you and I have not had the chance to speak since a federal judge dismissed most of the claims in the U.S. women's national team's lawsuit against U.S. soccer. The judge rejected the women's request for equal pay, but kept alive claims that women had been subjected to discriminatory working conditions. What do you make of this ruling?
It's going to create a mess for U.S. soccer because the ill feelings will now not go away. I don't know what their relationship with their sponsors is going to be now, since it's the women who are bringing in most of the collateral money, since they win and the men don't. I think U.S. soccer has got a lot of fences to mend.
In some ways, the women's success worked against them. The lawsuit focused on 2015 through 2019. And during that time, the U.S. women won two World Cups while the men didn't even qualify. And because the men did not earn the bonuses that would have come with qualifying for the World Cup, the judge determined that the women had actually been paid more than the men. Are you moved by that argument?
No, not at all. You're going to penalize the women for being successful because the men weren't. Logically, that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me.
Both teams are paid under collective bargaining agreements. In other words, the women negotiated this deal, and courts are hesitant to strike down CBAs. What will it take for the women to overcome that obstacle on appeal?
Well, they're going to have to play intense hardball when the next CBA comes along. U.S. soccer went scorched earth on this particular lawsuit and won.
53-year-old Mike Tyson said this week that he's in the best shape of his life and planning to fight in some exhibition matches. And then 57-year-old Evander Holyfield basically said, "Hold my beer." What's going on?
Or more to the point, hold my ear.
Oh, gosh. No. They are both apparently planning to fight for charity. Please tell me they're not planning to fight each other.
You know they're going to. Somebody will offer them a lot of money to fight each other, and that will be disgusting and awful and repulsive, and nobody should buy it. Just write a check to whatever charity it is, you know? Don't buy the fight.
Charlie, I'd like to direct your attention to the Ultimate Garden Clash. This was a pole vaulting event. It was pole vaulting. That is a sport. Held last weekend between three of the biggest names in men's pole vaulting, with each man competing from his own backyard.
They are absolutely
dead level here. This is brilliant. It's live sport once again. It's unbelievable.
And I watched some of this. It was way better than watching blurry images of basketball stars play horse, don't you think?
Oh, I think so too, but these people have some considerable backyards.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it takes you got to have a runway. You got to make sure all the trees are clear, cuz that could be really bad. And what if you like overshoot and wind up in your neighbor's backyard?
Oof.
That's going to be hard to explain.
And finally, Charlie, this is the sound of Halftor Bjornsson, better known as the Mountain from Game of Thrones, setting a new world record by deadlifting 1,104.5 pounds. Victory has never sounded sweeter, has it?
Or more raucous, for that matter. he lifts it about to his waist and then puts it down, which is, you know, all he had to do.
Right.
So if people are waiting for him to, like, triumphantly hold this thing over his head, y'all are out of your minds, because nobody can do that, not even Mountain.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Karen.
Last month, Miami Heat forward Jimmy Butler bought a portable hoop for his home so he could keep his skills sharp during the pandemic. He liked his new hoop so much, he bought one for every Heat player and coach. But basketball hoops aren't so easy to come by if you're on a budget. Here's reporter Judith Kogan.
One way to track the coronavirus timeline is by demand for goods and the difficulty of finding them. First, it was hand sanitizer. Then toilet paper, then yeast and flour, then hair dye. Now, it's near impossible to buy a portable basketball hoop, the kind you put in a driveway, pouring sand or water into the base for stability. True confession here? This is no catastrophe for me. I'm 5'1" and kind of a slug. Tiddlywinks is more my speed. But some years back, as the mother of three sports-obsessed teenage boys, I started shooting hoops with them in a confined concrete space just outside our back door. It was thrilling to connect in their zone. One of those sons, now a 30-year-old graphic designer in New York City, has come to quarantine with me in suburban Boston. Back in New York, he plays basketball every single day.
I work freelance. I work for myself, so I work alone all day. So going for the 3 o'clock basketball game at the gym is my one reason to leave the house.
Matthew and I get along fine, but he's going stir crazy. The house I moved to after my sons left home lacks a basketball hoop, and Matthew is in basketball withdrawal. So we consult the internet about purchasing a portable hoop. Reasonable ones can be found where expected. Amazon, Target, Walmart, Dick's Sporting Goods. By reasonable, I mean $250 or $300. But there are zero available for pickup within 100 miles of Boston. There are places that'll ship, but there's always the caveat. It'll ship in 2 months. The shipping cost is equal to the cost of the item itself.
You can't practice baseball alone. You can't really practice soccer alone, but you can just shoot jump shots all day long, and you can get that little endorphin rush every time you see the ball go through the nylon.
We are allowed to walk, and walk we do. One walk took Matthew to a shuttered school where he noticed an open basketball hoop. It was either an invitation to play or a setup for a sting operation.
I've been feeling real antsy in quarantine, and I figured I'd take my chances.
The sound of the ball echoes within 100 yards of the hoop. If anyone's around, we're toast.
Might be a short-lived basketball session. Much anticipated, though.
The ground is uneven and cracked. Weeds here, mud there. The backboard is plywood that's been painted white, bolted onto drainage pipes. And the hoop seems higher than 10 feet. Who cares? It's all part of the charm. I take a turn.
Nothing but rim.
Matthew suggests we play a game of horse and reminds me how it goes. One person makes a shot. If successful, the other has to successfully make the same shot or gets a letter. H-O-R-S-E. The first one to complete the shameful word loses. Matthew goes first.
Showing off with one hand.
I failed to take in the shot's full difficulty.
Left hand, too.
I don't subscribe to notions about birth order, but Matthew is a middle child, feisty and competitive. But when I get a basket, he seems genuinely excited.
Look at you.
Ready for the NBA.
Matthew makes hard shots I cannot replicate.
You gotta put a lot of mustard on this one.
I take the shot and miss.
Ah! Needed more mustard. No, needed more. Like strong, grainy stuff.
More mustard.
Matthew has to constantly remind me of the rules.
Because you only get a letter when you miss a shot that I'd hit.
Got it.
But I don't. He'll need to remind me over and over. I set up and make the next shot.
Okay, your turn.
He gets an H. I wonder if he's humoring me. Matthew announces my losing score more often than I think necessary. I realize that playing basketball, Matthew is now adult and child, mentor and competitor, fantasist and realist. It's the zone where the contradictory aspects of his personality get integrated.
I like that you shoot from the same spot every time.
This is mom's strategy, sticking with a winning formula. While I'm getting free passes here and there, somehow his game has gone south.
Oh, man.
All right, H-O-R to H-O-R-S.
What do you think?
It's getting close. We're in the fourth quarter.
Are you scared?
I am.
He calls a difficult shot.
All right, from here, no backboard.
He makes it.
Oh, that was sweet.
All right. She has to hit this to stay alive.
No backboard? That's too many challenges for me. I shoot, and then I'm a dead horse. In a way, we were playing different games. Endorphins flooded both our systems, but for different reasons. He's building on 25 years of balletic twisting, turning, and strategizing to hear the swish of the ball in the nylon. I'm rocking dormant maternal hormones. Nonetheless, we've both won, and we've evaded capture.
All right, let's get out of here before the feds come.
He shoots a basket.
At the buzzer!
In the pandemic, nothing is certain. No timelines, no retail availability. What does seem clear, however, is that at least one guy's passion can accommodate his mother's jump shot. And that opens up unimagined doors of confinement.
That's reporter Judith Kogan. And because it bears repeating, Only a Game would like to remind you to always maintain proper social distancing. And please, consult local guidelines before playing sports outside. Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. And to all the moms out there, especially my own, who listens every week even though she hates sports, happy Mother's Day, and thanks for listening.